Hello, my name is Dan Brown, and we are here today again with another Lenses on Information Architecture conversation. And today I get to talk to Kevin Hawkins. Kevin, thanks for joining me.
Yes, happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Kevin, you are a product design leader. And so I wanted to ask you to talk just a little bit about how do you draw people in to the product design process? How do you draw people who are not themselves product designers? Maybe they're stakeholders or subject matter experts. What sort of tools and techniques do you use to bring people into the product design process?
Certainly. I think everyone has a couple of skills that are really relevant in the process. I think there's people who are really good at looking at the business side, seeing what's competitive, what expectations are based on what other products or services provide. There are some people who really are able to kind of identify use cases and the customers care about being able to accomplish a certain task or a certain goal. And then there's others who come in from more of like an engineering standpoint, and they're like, this is a feature, this is a table stake, things like that. I think using, you know, figuring out the language of the person you're working with, facilitating a big group with different personalities, different personas, different backgrounds, but realizing each person's kind of strengths, weaknesses is how you kind of weave them all together.
Is there one sort of facilitation technique that you like? Is there one sort of means or sort of workshop activity that you like to do to bring all of these different perspectives together?
Certainly. I think like initially I use just like basic simple things like here are all of our user stories, you know, can you rank order them? And you see people obviously will do them in very different orders for different reasons. Sometimes they contradict each other. Other times, you know, if it's in the IA, you know, I literally have my internal teams, the department leaders do card sorting, and you can really just see how everyone associates different value to different areas of the product or to different customers. But a lot of times I just do how might we.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I'm, as an information architect, I'm especially interested in how we design structures. Can you talk to me a little bit about what steps you take at the beginning of the process to clarify a product's structure? You mentioned card sorts. Are there other things that kind of come to mind that deal with kind of that underlying, let's say, kind of roadmap or map of sort of the overall structure of a product?
Certainly. Yeah, I just left one of these kind of workshops that facilitated where we kept running into the issue that I try to resolve really early on, which is, you know, how far down the roadmap can we predict? Is a choice we make today going to be quickly invalidated by a business choice or a new feature or a new department or a market segmentation we support? So I look for, you know, what is our mission? What are the strongest indicators of success for the business? What are our top KPIs? And then what are things in the roadmap that are safe, that we're not going to be changing, that are kind of our foundation or stable for the next, let's say, 6, 12, 18 months, hopefully longer than that if you're not a startup, so that you can easily kind of use them as rocks in your IA versus things you have to worry about changing and reteaching the user.
Oh, I like the idea of sort of looking for safe spaces, if you will, or safe kind of concepts that you can kind of ground the entire information architecture around. I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about sort of how do you know when a concept is safe? How do you know when in the product that you're working on, you can look at something and say, you know what, this is an anchor point that we can count on to remain at least somewhat stable over the course of the product's lifetime?
Certainly. I think there are, this is where the mixture of like product strategy and design strategy come into play. So if you have big bets or you have table stakes that are validated that you know the customers will always want, it's a requirement, you know, even as far as to say it's a table stake, so it's a basic expectation that they will always want or need, those are some of the first places where you can have those strong, stable concepts. The second places would be areas where you deviate from status quo. So this is your big bet. This might be something that's in your moat or your, you know, your value proposition that's unique to your product. But if you've confirmed that this is successful, that this is drawing in a larger customer, that this is unique to the market and that you're going to keep doing this because it works, that might be another area where you have this kind of foundational concept.
Nice. What, if I can ask, or what sort of tools or techniques are you using to capture information architecture and convey that to the rest of the team? How do you, I mean, I feel like there's been an enormous pendulum over the course of my career anyway, to go from sort of elaborate diagrams to sort of putting those to the side and just focusing on screens. It feels like there's maybe a greater interest in creating some diagrams, at least as a means for communicating some of the complexity in the underlying structure, whether that's a sitemap or a flow. Where are you at right now? What are some of the tools that your teams are using to help communicate, socialize, kind of get feedback on the structural decisions that you're making?
Yeah, certainly. I use a mixture of tools. So we use a lot of Miro. Miro is just, of course, they've kind of grown, especially during the pandemic. But it's just a really great tool for us to have a different style of diagramming without the kind of complexity or the knowledge of knowing what the nodes have to be for yes, no, or any of these kind of things. With our team using Figma, we started using a lot of FigJam, because kind of like, again, that same easy learning curve to just do easy diagramming, nodes, attached lines, the connectors. But we oftentimes, to get faster input, let's say we're trying to ask everyone the same question, we'll actually just send a survey through Slack and kind of get a quick response from everyone. And this helps inform or actually kind of shrink the size of the workshop we need to facilitate. If we already know, people's opinions on the roadmap or on the customer journey or kind of the actions that their team takes in the service blueprint, that does also kind of help us when we're doing some of this work.
That's awesome. I went from like never using Miro to always using Miro practically overnight. I mean, it was almost like Slack, I went from obviously never using because it didn't exist to then always using. And I mean, the pandemic, I suspect, kind of accelerated some of these things,
Totally.
just given the remote nature of our work. But I also feel like these were tools that were probably long needed, right? To lower those barriers to entry, for these more collaborative and kind of more, structural conversations that we need to have.
Yes, I agree.
So the whole point of this conversation is to sort of say, how can we look at our work in a new way? I guess, is there one aspect of product design or user experience more generally that you feel like needs us to revisit? Maybe there's kind of some underlying preconceptions that you feel like haven't been examined enough, that are so entrenched that we just take them for granted and are really assumptions that need some kind of questioning. Is there one aspect of the design process that you think needs to be examined more closely?
It's a challenging one because I think it's different for the different stage of companies. But I think a lot of times, let's say between 0 to 1, so anything that's a new product launch, a startup, even like a new service line for a larger company, there's just the design process does not, I think, accurately articulate the way customers perceive value. So we say, oh, our competitors are doing this, or customers have this need or this job to be done. But who's to say that the how is this method of getting that job done is accurate? We oftentimes are not properly vetting some of the research, and like there's all these debates about how large the sample size should be, and is that really what the customer meant? So I think that design process could really dig a bit deeper into kind of the clarifying needs aspect.
Really interesting to me. So, just to reflect that back, make sure I got it right. Your sense is that although there's been a bunch of research to identify a potential need, that we then, as a design process, kind of go and create a how, a way to kind of meet that need. But there's sort of a gray area, a fuzzy part of that process once you said after product launch, where it's like, is this really meeting a need? Is this doing the job that we set out to do? Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
So have you made any changes to your process? Have you thought about doing any tweaks? Have you considered kind of seeing what you might do differently to address this?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like if anyone who's listening to this is a UX researcher or UX writer, it's probably the thing they deal with on a daily basis. It's just the methods we choose start to get very repetitive. Some companies really put all their eggs on A/B testing, others put all their eggs on unmoderated usability testing. But we as designers and researchers and people in the UX craft know that these tools and some of these techniques are very specific for certain types of data we want. So if you want qualitative attitudinal versus behavioral, I mean, they can't solve for everything. They can't predict everything, which is why we'll have great test results, but then we'll have really bad performance or outcomes in the product. And I think we should just get better at realizing that if we are uncertain about multiple areas of research, we have to conduct multiple types of research before we're confident to release a product feature.
Awesome. If we're uncertain about multiple areas, we need to employ many different in research instruments to test them out. And it feels like, I mean, we again went from sort of 0 to 60 in terms of the different kinds of research tools that are available to us at relatively low cost, right? We can do, as long as we've got the participants, there's lots of different kinds of things that we can do to test our products. Is there a kind of testing that you're doing today that you really like or really gravitate towards?
Yeah, there's like a it's sometimes it's called dark UX, but like when you actually present a full feature or a full product to a customer that isn't real, just to test their actual willingness to buy or their willingness to interact, but then not actually having the full customer journey ready. So you're able to kind of like test the interest level, actually see engagement, real interaction, but you need more time. So there's like a waiting list or there's a delay. It doesn't work for everything, and it can be unethical in some businesses and some areas of products, but I think it's really useful when you're selling from 0 to 1. I think it's also super useful if you're making a drastic redesign, because you see oftentimes people have the ability to go back to like the old version of this page or the old version of this flow, but you never got a preview before. Sometimes it's like drastically shifts and you can't go back. So I think there's just more room for these kind of pivots.
So, at what point in your, if I can ask you to reflect back kind of on your career, was there a moment that you felt like in your career where you realized this sort of dependence on the same old testing techniques was a problem? Was there kind of a moment in the work that you were doing where you felt like, you know what, we've identified the problem, we've created a solution, and we just have no idea if we are actually meeting the need, and the testing techniques available to us are insufficient for telling us that. What moment in your career do you feel like that kind of light bulb went off for you?
Yeah, I've had the light bulb go off twice. The first time was the first time I was the first employee of a startup, and I grew the design team and the organization from scratch. And you're limited by resources and bandwidth and the number of people you have to be able to conduct 16 hours of interviews and then analysis of the interviews and then conclusions and then also make the designs and QA the changes. It's just there's so much going on there and a small team full resources. But then I've had the same thing happen again to me at the big corporate side of design. I was at Booking.com. They're notorious for A/B testing, and it's a really amazing tool when you have millions of customers per minute coming to a site to drive traffic through a multivariate test, A/B test. But you oftentimes are missing the why. Why are they doing this? We know that people who took A versus B got the task done faster, but do we know why? Is it, can I accurately say this one word change created a 40% change? Do I know if the holidays had an impact or any outside variables? So there's a lot of just these missing details when you rely too heavily on one type of data.
Yeah, that's and when you see it in action, like you're sort of it sort of comes across as very stark, right? This sort of like, oh, wait, we keep doing these same kinds of tests over and over again, and we keep missing this very important piece of information from the tests. Why do we keep doing the same kind of test over again? These A/B tests, for example. I mean, and I love qualitative interviews, but even that only can take you so far. Yes, because of the limit in the number of participants, but also the nature of the process. Yeah. The interviewer is very much injecting to that process. Have you found that as well?
Yeah, certainly. Like, bias is always like the, I'd say, the number one factor for research, like operations. But there's certain types of research that has, you know, a greater risk for bias, especially if the only way to conduct it is user to user or person to person. If there is monetary variable where you're being paid to, if you keep getting the same testers who are maybe more likely to understand what you're trying to hear, what you're trying to test before they've been, you know, exposed to it. These are all kind of biases that start to creep in when you rely too heavily on one method.
So I've been using these interviews a little bit as therapy. So I'm sorry about this, but I sense that you can really help me out with this. I have a lot of preconceptions now here in the, let's call them, middle chapters of my career, and I'm trying to unpack some of those preconceptions. And one of those, and actually I've encountered this a lot recently, is that we should design for the happy path and then kind of prioritize the edge cases as appropriate, whatever that prioritization scheme is. And we designed for the happy path because, you know, back in the day we were like, well, 80% of our users, 60% of our users are going through that happy path. And I think it's always been like a dirty little secret, right? Like, well, yeah, but no, because there's something always that goes wrong. Like every user has something that sort of takes them off the happy path. Where are you at with this sort of preconception that we should design for the happy path and then prioritize the edge cases? Do you feel like that is a still a useful rule? Do you feel like we need to revisit that rule? How would you counsel someone like me who's trying to figure out the right way to do this?
Yeah, this is a challenging one. And it's, again, this is one that I see a lot of corporate, and it kind of has a bit of the, you know, if you build it, they will come. And it has a bit of the, you know, this is the way we've always done things, you know, it has both of these concepts kind of blended in, because, you know, if this is the way it works, and this is the way everyone knows it works, and this is one of the only options they have, of course, you're going to get 80% of people using this path, because they don't have freedom of will, and they don't have freedom of, you know, efficiency of navigation in the product, you know, which you oftentimes talk about when you talk about UX heuristics. But in reality, it's like, we can't do everything, we can't give them every option. So I understand how it happens. But then you kind of have to figure out, I kind of call it the expiration of design. You know, how long have we been using this solution? Have we actually tested if it's still doing what we thought it was doing back then? How often, or how, when's the last time we tested this? The results were negative, you know, 2 years ago when we tested it. Has the market shifted significantly? Has user demand, biases, standards, status quo shifted? Should we test it again? Has, you know, has that solution to the problem expired? Maybe it's time for a new one.
Yeah, and I feel like this notion of happy path maybe needs to be revisited. For me, it was fairly recently as we were working through a flow, and we realized that the happy path is happy only for those people who are in a privileged position, and that really the edge cases were meant to support people. Not support, but we're meant to deal with folks in a less privileged position. And that it, you know, if you sort of look at it in terms of, you know, how much of an advantage someone has, or, you know, how easy this is for them to do, we've got folks in a less privileged position who are already, say, trying to catch up, just to use a very stark term. And by not supporting these edge cases, where it felt like we were setting them back even further, which is not something, not a view that I think I would have readily adopted even 10 years ago, But now, sort of given the climate of digital design, this feels like a more responsible, even if immature, way of looking at it.
No, I would totally agree. I think a lot of use cases in UX are tied to the people, right? Tied to the user. And so something about a happy path also relies on something being common or being average or being the norm, which inherently has a mixture of inclusivity and exclusivity involved. If this is, you know, non-traditional, or this is not the highest, most common thing or use case, is it because no one has this problem, or is it because the people who have this problem are not the people we normally solve for?
Kevin, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me on this little journey.
Yeah, certainly. This is great.